Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast, the best transatlantic football podcast on the entire planet. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host today, and joining me from London all the way in San Diego is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yes, I'm very good. It's beautiful and sunny in San Diego, so of course I'm happy, mate. Lovely times. How are you, mate?
Yeah, it's absolutely pouring with rain here. It's been dark, dismal and drab, basically, which is the London that I know and the London that I love. So I'm actually quite happy. I managed to get the jeans, hoodie, winter coat out today. I was absolutely delighted with that, Dean. I'm not going to complain about it. This is the kind of season I like to get involved in.
I don't even have a winter coat anymore.
Well, that's it. You know, these are the different styles of life we live. You're a sunshine man and I like the rain. Winter's my favourite season, and people get funny about that kind of statement, but I love it. I love getting
it's a weird one.
Cozy, cuddled. Weird. Great stuff.
Yeah, I don't like to be cold. I don't.
No, well, which is probably why you moved to San Diego. So
it almost certainly is. It's not the only reason, obviously, but I could have picked anywhere in America and here we are.
Here you are, indeed. Today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. It is something that we've touched on before. It was something we did all the way back at Bleacher Report. We called it at that point Jenga pieces, the piece you could take out of any club and the club would be most likely to fall apart. We did a little bit last year with Harry Brooks when he was on here talking about the most important pieces, most important players for a couple of Premier League teams. Today, we're going to do it with European giants. Now, we are in the middle of a Champions League week at the time of recording. You will have watched the Tuesday games by the time you are listening to this, maybe even the Wednesday games as well. And we will be back, of course, with a Champions League takeaway on Wednesday night after those games have finished tomorrow. But we're going to do this today, Dean, and I think it's probably best we kind of take out the midweek results, etc., out of this. It's going to be a bit more holistic look at it. But we're going to look at those players who are maybe the key piece for their club, that if you took them out, the stone on which it's built, the rock on which they're built, if you took them out, things are most likely to crumble. And we're kind of coming to this off the back of Rodri's injury, right? This is the event that has triggered this discussion once again. And we've seen it a couple of times around various things. It's always one of those topics that I think is intriguing. But we're going to look at some clubs, and it feels right, I think, to start with Manchester City, given that they were the jumping off point for this entire topic.
Yeah, probably is most wise, mate. Look, I think having no replacement for Rodri is an oversight. I think it's something that they will regret. It's something they certainly had considered. So now they're kind of left to figure it out. Obviously, of all the squads in the Premier League, they're pretty well stacked in comparison to most of them. You could probably argue that there's only Liverpool that would be as well or better prepared for a moment like this one. And yeah, losing Rodri, absolutely no doubt about it, affects Manchester City in terms of retaining the title and winning it for the fifth season in a row. Also opens the door for the potential for Arsenal or Liverpool to nick it off them. So I think that's very interesting. I have seen a stat actually in the last 10 minutes, an Opta predictor on Sky Sports, which says that Man City are 73% likely to win the Premier League. It's actually ranked the top six, basically, in terms of percentages.
I did see this.
Yeah, our Fulham, sixth placed Fulham, have got 0% chance of winning the league, according to this. Which is just, put more respect on the name, put more respect on the badge.
To be fair, I'm willing to accept that. Willing to accept that Fulham have 0%.
It's actually really funny, though, to just have Liverpool 9%, Arsenal 17%, Chelsea 0.28%. Villa 0.6, and there's Fulham absolutely zero chance of winning the league. But Man City still a 73% chance of winning the league.
That's a drive-by, by the way. Why didn't they just do the top five? why have we taken the brunt of this?
Yeah, sixth isn't even like necessary, is it? But can they deal without Rodri? That's the big question, because last season when he wasn't there, obviously that's when they lost their games. That's when suddenly everything came under the microscope. And, you know, we've just recorded this right now on the back of their Champions League match and they've gone and won 4-0, but it's obviously a pretty straightforward Champions League fixture, as we do expected, against Slovan Bratislava. But they're going to have bigger problems down the line, bigger fixtures down the line. And now, who is their most important player? I mean, shall I just go into it, or you've got anything to add to this before I get there?
No, absolutely. I think we should definitely just get stuck into it. But it is one of those where I still think you can say Rodri. Like, I think Rodri is still a reasonable answer for this question.
You still put him out there because he's that important.
Well, it's just like one of those. But I do think that City have kind of done this in two different ways, right? And this is where it comes to this discussion, because selling Julian Alvarez in the summer has left them short in the other position where they have, you know, an absolute world beater. And so therefore you've got this kind of bizarre thing where City squad, as you say, is incredibly stacked, incredibly well put together in the most part. But in their two key positions, and maybe this is part of it, right? Is it very difficult to bring in players who want to play second fiddle to the best player in their world in that position? So you're looking at it and thinking, well, they're a bit light up top and they're a bit light in defensive midfield. If Rodri goes down, if Erling Haaland goes down, where are City left?
Yeah, well, you've just ruined that. The most important player left at Man City is Erling Haaland. Like, that is a fact.
To be fair, if that comes as a spoiler for anyone at this point, I'd be very surprised.
Look, if Erling Haaland gets injured, they might as well burn down the Etihad. It's all over. It's done. It would genuinely be a disaster, at least until we get to January, if suddenly Erling wasn't out there, because they couldn't cope with it. They don't have the depth there to deal with that right now. I'm sure Pep would come up with some bizarre plan and suddenly, I don't know, KDB had become a number nine overnight or something. But yeah, with Rodri out as well, as you say, and neither of these positions having the proper backup, yeah, the situation where they could lose Haaland, and that's how you really do judge who the most important player is, like how would they cope without them, is a nightmare reality. I mean, you look at the Premier League this season, Haaland's got 10 goals from 6 games. You look across last season at Erling Haaland, he got 38 goals in all competitions, which by his standards isn't actually that good. But, you know, when he wasn't there, he did miss 10 games. It's worth bearing in mind. Last season, Haaland was gone for 10 games. They had Alvarez to step in. Did a good job of it. So I don't think there's any doubt, given what we've seen so far this season, that this is going to be the case of him being their most important player. Now, the problem with Guardiola and the Rodri thing is that he's going to overthink it, right? And he's going to come up with some bizarre plans over the coming months and coming games as to who goes into those positions. And you already started to kind of see it in that Arsenal game, actually, how Pep's brain was fried because he didn't know how to break down that low block. It wasn't even a low block. It was a wall that Arsenal built against Manchester City. And he was so frustrated. Now, Kovacic, good player. He's not up to it.
Isn't he? We'll see.
I don't think he is, mate. And I've spoken to a few City fans who are worried he's not as well. Like, I've seen Kovacic put in some really good shifts, so I feel a bit bad saying that. But based on what a few City fans that I've spoken to really think, they're like, I would rather just not have Kovacic on the pitch unless it's really, really necessary. I'm like, wow, are you really like that good that you can just say that? Apparently they are.
I mean, so what do they do? Statistics back it up, right? They are very good.
Yeah, I think what we know is that Bernardo Silva, Kevin De Bruyne and Phil Foden suddenly become elevated in terms of status and importance for Manchester City during this period, because at some point Haaland will miss a game and Rodri, as we know, is going to miss a lot of games. And those three players fill those kind of roles between them, if you like. Now, I don't think he'll play Bernardo Silva as a six, but I think he could. I think that he could put him in there. It's a different type, obviously, but I wouldn't surprise me if he tries it at some point. KDB, he's talked before about the fact that there's potential for KDB to move further back and be like a deep-lying playmaker, if you like, as he gets further into his career. Maybe we see that once De Bruyne is back in action. And Foden can just, you know, if Haaland does go missing, can try to make the most of that opportunity as well if he gets it. But yeah, it's going to be very interesting, and finding the right balance is going to be key. I'm gutted for Rodri, like, just to go back to that point. I think it's a massive shame, and I hated seeing him go out of that fixture because it took something away from the game itself.
Yeah.
But what it does do is it does give us a much more tasty title race.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's interesting seeing the links that City have been having in recent days. Samuele Ricci from Torino, one that's being pushed at the moment in the media, linked to Fulham actually this summer, and I thought that would be a good signing, and suddenly he's being linked to Manchester City as a potential Rodri replacement. So I'm pleased that that's gone well for me. But generally, kind of, you look at this, and I suppose that the question with City, and it would have been this right from the start. Now, it's probably influenced a little bit by the idea that this is Rodri and Haaland now, and Rodri's already obviously out. But at the start of the season, if you'd said to 100 City fans, would you rather lose Haaland or Rodri for the season? Do you think that more people would have said Haaland than Rodri?
Rather lose Haaland?
Yeah.
No. No. Okay. No, yeah. I don't, because it's like, that is like, he's the best goal scorer in the world right now. Yeah. And I just don't think that anyone would. That's why you watch football, is to see goals. That is the most important thing in football, is goals. And they've got the best guy in the world at that. And that is what ultimately does win you things. Now, I know that Rodri's role is difficult / impossible to replicate, and that his personality on this team is probably also impossible to replicate. But you're never going to see another Erling Haaland again in your life, right? Guarantee you it. Like, the geezer's unbelievable. Hey?
What about Liam Delap?
Liam Delap's about as close as you're going to get, yeah. So I don't think that there should have been. If they are, they're crazy, because I think that Haaland should be, he's the ultimate player for me that you would want in your team.
Fair enough. I mean, my hand would go in for Rodri here. If you were gonna have to save one of them for the season, I would have taken Rodri.
You wouldn't have any goals. Who's gonna score their goals?
I mean, I think they would have found a solution. I think that Pep is more, you know,
if you think about it.
They won the league without Haaland, where they didn't play a number nine for basically an entire year. Seen them do it before.
But they struggled. There was periods where, and actually it's funny you say that, because I saw a video on it yesterday, and somebody was playing like a compilation of City attacking before Haaland, and they're basically passing the ball around the 6-yard box, waiting for someone to shoot, and like everyone, and like all these chances going begging because they were just so good at passing, but no one would put it in the back of the net. And it's like, this was the moment Pep decided he needed Haaland, basically. And I was like, yeah, that's right. I kind of forget. Like,
but it was unbelievable. The league.
They still won the league, yeah. But yeah. Maybe everyone else was rubbish at the time, because it shouldn't have happened.
I just fundamentally don't believe that to be true. But we are where we are. And look, we're on different sides of that debate. That's absolutely fine. This is what this podcast and this conversation is all about. I mean, look, you talked about a title race there. I think we should probably discuss the other two teams in it. So let's move on to Liverpool or Arsenal. You take your pick.
I'm going to go with Arsenal, just because this is the perceived to be the main contender to Manchester City's crown, and they've got this new rivalry, and they just played each other recently. So who's the most important player? I mean, they've obviously got a lot. They've got a lot of important players. But who's irreplaceable? Who's the guy that if he's not there, you're not going to win the title? Who's the guy that's already counting himself this season as making the difference? It's the goalkeeper. It's David Raya. I think David Raya has become the most important player in this Arsenal team. And I don't think many people would have expected me to say that, mate. When I started looking at this myself, I didn't think I'd come out saying this. But look, on Patreon on Monday, please do, by the way, come over there if you're not already a member of the Rank Squad Ultras. subscriptions available, of course, and we have a great time discussing all of the games that have just happened. And we were asked the question by one of our patrons, is David Raya now the best goalkeeper in the world? Now, if that question is even being asked, then he's doing something very, very right. Now, we actually came out of that conversation and say, probably not the best, but even if you're ranking a top five and he's in it, then he's come a long way.
I think we came to the conclusion that he was probably the best performing goalkeeper this season, but maybe not the best in the world.
Yeah, and do you know what? If you think about what we've seen so far this season in English football, we've seen two games, not even English football because one of them was in Europe, but we've seen two games this season where David Raya has made saves that were game-defining and also unforgettable. And I don't think there are many moments in time that still stand out to me when a goalkeeper has had that sort of influence and it hasn't been in a team that have gone on to be very successful. So I'd say someone like Peter Schmeichel, for example, would make worldy saves. He had this different way of goalkeeping that kind of changed everything and helped Man United get to where they were back in the 90s. But David Raya also, over the past year, 18 months, has like elevated his status in the game. He's doing brilliantly, and he's worth, I don't know how many points he's going to be across this season, but he will keep them in the title race. And I think when you go through the Arsenal team, they've built the team well enough that everybody's backed up pretty much, especially all the key guys. Like you could say, well, is Saka definitely backed up?
Mm.
I think he is. I think Saka is, because I think you've got enough options across that front line now that Saka can be replaced. And I don't think that, I'm not saying Saka's output has been bad this season, but I don't
six
think
assists
it's been
his first six games in the Premier League.
But they're assists. It's not like they're he's scoring. He's not like a Cole Palmer influence on Chelsea. It's something that somebody else could have done. Like his corners are obviously like on a sixpence, like unbelievable, and all of this. Like that's fine. Like, I'm not saying Saka's a bad player here. I'm just saying that I think we might have reached the stage where the goalkeeper at Arsenal is their most important player because he's so good.
It's a good argument, and actually one that I hadn't considered. And I was tossing this one up in my head, and I was trying to decide between Saka and William Saliba. That was the big one. And I just want to cast your mind back a little bit to March 2023, because there was a moment in that title race. Well, it actually wasn't played in the Premier League. It was a Europa League game. And you might remember that Arsenal played Sporting and they ended up losing that game on penalties. But the most important thing that happened that day was that William Saliba went off injured with a back injury. And so a lot of things came crashing down. At that point, Arsenal were 5 points clear, top of the Premier League table. And after that, they, out of their next nine games, if I'm not mistaken, I think they won four, drew three and lost two. And with a game left to go, or two games left to go, they were 4 points behind Manchester City and the title race was all but dead. That's pretty stunning in terms of the change around. Now, the counter argument I would suggest you could make now is that they have strengthened in the additions that they've made, not just this summer, but the summer afterwards, to make sure that, you know, that kind of thing doesn't happen again. They have a lot of players that can play in there. We've seen Ben White obviously play at centre back at times. We've seen Calafiori come in. He's played a lot of left back, but you'd imagine he would be able to move into further inside and do a job there as well. But I do still wonder if Saliba's influence and kind of calming influence has a way of just making this Arsenal side feel like they are much more in control. You remember some of these games, right? The absolute antics of that game against Southampton, where it was head in hands all over the time. They were 2-0 up against Liverpool. Liverpool came roaring back to draw 2-2. A lot of that felt like if Saliba was there, it just wouldn't have happened. And I think that that's the really interesting thing with that one. We don't have necessarily the same data to back it up at this point, but that kind of thing hangs on me. And I think his influence and the kind of lack of him in that title race getting to Arsenal means that him getting lost at any point would be absolutely a brutal hit to Arsenal's title hopes.
Yeah, I mean, they have, as you say, got better depth now, and that's the reason they've gone and chased down these guys. And they've got, yeah, obviously Timber and Calafiori are playing fullback at the moment, but they've got them as adaptable players. I mean, I would argue you could, if in an emergency, you could even drop Declan Rice back if you had to and bring in one of the other midfielders and allow him to play at the back. I guess the main concern would be that the partnership between Saliba and Gabriel has become so strong that, that partnership is probably as important as David Raya. I'd probably argue that if you were to take Saliba out. It's not that the player couldn't be replaced, it's that the combination and the understanding between those two couldn't be replaced. So, yeah, there's definitely an argument there. Look, there isn't a right or wrong answer on a lot of this. Everybody's going to have a different view on who they perceive to be their club's most important player. Obviously, I'm going to be right.
He says 10 seconds after saying there's no right answer.
I'm the oldest. I get to choose.
It's my ball. You can't play with it.
Basically. But, yeah, I've surprised myself to be sat here saying I think David Raya has become Arsenal's most important player.
You make a compelling case. I mean, let's move on to Liverpool before we take a break. Is it just obvious, this one?
It wasn't as obvious as I think. I honestly started looking at it and okay, so is it Van Dijk? You're like, okay, it probably is Van Dijk, but who else could it be? And you're like, well, actually, obviously, if you're going to look for experience and game changers, then Salah needs to be considered at the very least. So is it Salah? Then you're like, well, what else needs to be considered? And you're like, okay, well, Trent and Gravenberch are actually the most important players to the system that is now being employed. So how important is that in comparison to the elitism of Virgil and Salah? And it was difficult. In the end, I actually ended up texting a couple of my Liverpool mates who go to a lot of the games, because I thought, well, do you know what? This input is actually very valuable. Like, they are watching the game in the stadium, and I think that always has a sense of...
You get a pulse on the fans, I think, in a way that you don't elsewhere.
You really do. And all of them said, it's Virgil van Dijk. They were like, it's just Virgil van Dijk. And I said, yeah, I assume that is true, but I'm just kind of like trying to convince myself that it's definitely the case. And basically they were like, you have to look at what the drop-off is if we don't have the other players. You say, okay, so say Alisson as well. Throw Alisson into the mix. He should be in the conversation, but we already played without Alisson and we're fine without him. So you're like, okay, that's a fair point. They're like, Salah, obviously a legend, extremely important, but he hasn't actually been in form. And yeah, he's still been important, but if you've watched the games, you wouldn't have watched it and thought, oh, we couldn't have got by without him today. So it's not Salah. Then you think, okay, Trent. Well, their argument was that actually, if you have to bring Bradley in, the drop-off, it's not the same. You're not getting the same player, but the drop-off isn't actually that far because you will get through. It's a very good player. Yeah. And then they were like, do you know what? You're right about Gravenberch, and he probably is the one that under Slot has changed things the most and over the course of time could actually become the most important player. But Virgil van Dijk, if he's not there, this team could nosedive. Like, that spot, the combinations around him, the experience, his stature, his calmness, his technical ability, all of these things, and never mind the leadership, that is above and beyond everything for Liverpool in this season particularly, when they're in a new era. They're going to go for a title. They're top of the league. That's what makes him stand out. They need that leader at the back, especially one that's proved to be so good. Now, I've been of the opinion that at the end of this season, Liverpool could probably part ways with Virgil van Dijk at this stage of his career. But maybe I'm wrong, mate. Maybe they can't.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there is an argument to suggest that Virgil van Dijk is not as imperious as he was once, and that maybe there has been a slight drop-off. But equally, I do think you're right in that we spoke about Ibrahima Konate, and he's capable of the sublime and the ridiculous within the space of one game. Jarrell Kwanzaa is an incredible talent, but equally, at this point, we're kind of looking at and thinking you need to, you know, be honed in that talent to reach your full potential. I think it is interesting that, you know, aside from the League Cup game last week, it has always been Van Dijk with one of them. Now he's club captain. Obviously, you expect him to play every game he's fit and available for. But there is that kind of sense of, I think that Arne Slot just knows he has a lieutenant on the pitch and someone who dictates and actually does make things happen, who he can speak to and allow him to speak to the rest of the team, who allows them to kind of organize his troops on the pitch. And that, I think, goes above and beyond the performance levels. I'm sure there's Liverpool fans sitting here going, well, what about Luis Diaz, who was absolutely exceptional this year, but every time Cody Hakpo's played, he's been brilliant as well. So I don't think the drop-off's that deep on that side of the pitch. I honestly think that Gravenberch is probably the cool. If we were doing this podcast in March, April, we might be sitting here with a really credible argument that Ryan Gravenberch is that guy now for Liverpool. But I have a similar thing. We'll talk about Juventus later. I have a similar thing going on with them that right now I find it difficult to actually put that line down and say that line in the sand has already been crossed. I don't think it has yet for Liverpool. And so I think you're probably just about right in terms of this being Van Dijk.
Yeah, that was tricky though. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed debating in my head and having to get other people involved because it's not easy. Anyway, even McAllister even came into my thought at one point, you know, like they've got so many. That's part of the problem with it of Liverpool. And that's also their big strength.
Yeah, 100%. All right, we'll take a break there. And afterwards, we're going to be heading to the continent to discuss some of those giants and who their most important player is. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks AFC, where we're discussing the most important players for a lot of Europe's giants. And I'm going to take us across the channel to France, Dean, because I want to talk very briefly about PSG. This was really hard. And I was looking at this and thinking, well, last year this felt like a kind of no-brainer, right? And even when Mbappe was in and out of the team, there were moments where he was putting this side on his back and really kind of driving them towards the things that they were hoping for. And look, PSG ended up in a pretty tight title race at the end of last season. It was all a bit all over the place, and Mbappe's goals really did take them over the line. But now he's gone. Bradley Barcola has stepped up beautifully and again could be someone we're discussing towards the end of the season. Top scorer in Ligue 1 now, has really slotted into that role beautifully, and I'm really, really excited to see where his career goes. But I think it's a little bit early to be determining that Bradley Barcola is PSG's most important player. So I started looking through this team, and one of the great things about Luis Enrique's teams is that they feel like teams, right? And this was one of the main, I think, headbutting points that he had with Kylian Mbappe, in that times Mbappe felt bigger than the club or the 11 players on the pitch. Now, this year's PSG are different. They've been really dominant in France. We've just watched them lose 2-0 to Arsenal. So we're going to kind of just take that out for today. But I've decided that their great strength is their midfield. Now, Joao Neves came in the summer. He's been absolutely brilliant. I've really liked seeing him match up with Barcola on that left-hand side. We've seen a little bit more creative juice squeezed out of him by Lucho already. But I think, for me, this one feels like a three-way toss-up between Vitinha, Warren Zaïre-Emery, and Achraf Hakimi. Now, Hakimi has been so crucial to the way that this PSG team attacks for so long that it felt unfair to leave him out of the conversation. And he feels a bit now like the kind of marquee defensive player. Now, Marquinhos is there in this lineup, and you look at what PSG are doing and how they're kind of turning things around at the back. You also see the influx of new defenders. William Pacho has been absolutely brilliant this season. We've seen Lucas Beraldo play well in spurts as well. But it's been interesting kind of seeing which bits have stayed the same. And PSG's fullback combination of Nuno Mendes and Achraf Hakimi remains, for my money, probably the best in Europe. I think that the two of them together are absolutely sensational, and the way that they complement each other is incredible. But Hakimi has roles going forward and going backwards. And for that, I think he probably stands out a little bit more than Nuno Mendes in that he influences proceedings at both ends of the field. It also doesn't help that I don't think there's great backup for Hakimi in this PSG squad, and that actually to lose him would feel like a real hammer blow to their ambitions, maybe not domestically, but definitely in Europe. But I do keep coming back to Vitinha. Now, long-term listeners of this podcast will know that I'm a Vitinha stan. I've been a fanboy of his since long before he made this move from Porto to PSG.
Before he was born, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is possible at this point. But I think that the way he has grown into this team over the last couple of years, and, you know, he brought up his 100th PSG appearance tonight in that game against Arsenal. But you kind of look at it and you think, well, what's he become? Well, he's become a controller in this midfield. He's been trusted as being the player who's basically ended up replacing Marco Verratti in terms of what his role is in this PSG team. Zaire Emery's a bit more all action. He has that habit of getting around. He's a local lad. He's absolutely adored. And he's one of the best midfield talents in Europe. In fact, all three of PSG's first choice midfield are. But I think with Vitinha and the way that PSG operate, now he was pulled tonight quite early, so it's not a great moment to be actually discussing this. But in the way that PSG operate and the way that Luis Enrique wants them to operate, where the base midfielder or the player pulling the strings at the bottom of midfield is the kind of key to the cogs in all of the system. And look, we've seen Luis Enrique this week come out and be like, look, no one's bigger than the team. And the reason that Ousmane Dembele was not in the squad to play Arsenal was because the Luis Enrique didn't feel like he was fulfilling his duties to the squad in his time on the pitch in their win over Rennes last weekend. That's wild, right? To drop Ousmane Dembele, who, you know, Luis Enrique has also said previously is the most influential player in world football in terms of opening up attacks, is a big thing, but no one is bigger than the team in a Lucho system. And so for me, the player who dictates the way that that system operates is always the key piece. And I think for PSG in this era, that is Vitinha.
Mm. It's interesting. I've just actually quickly found it while you were saying that about Dembele. I saw a tweet this week and it said, if you want to know how important Ousmane Dembele has been to PSG this season, a quick glance at L'Equipe's player ratings for the season explains a lot. And Ousmane Dembele is top this season in terms of the ratings. Now, the replies start to say, yeah, but have you seen him the last couple of games? And maybe that's the point in case here. And it would that would be fitting with what Dembele has been throughout his career, obviously. Like now,
mercurial, right?
Yeah, I mean, he started to shake that off a bit. Like, I thought that maybe we were getting something different here, but maybe that's never going to totally go away. And then I guess you have got this Vitinha Zaire Emery conundrum as to decide, like, well, what is the most important thing then? What even separates these guys in terms of importance, in terms of the uplift that they give this team? And, you know, can you say that taking a teenager out of a team can be like that detrimental? Surely you should be better built than to live without somebody like that.
Not when they're this talented, I don't think.
Maybe not. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that, again, is a case in point of just how good this depth is. It's difficult for me to argue too much on PSG because I haven't watched loads of them across this season. But
I know for a fact it's not Gigi Donnarumma.
It's not Gigi Donnarumma. I've just seen him let one past him tonight in the Arsenal game. So it definitely ain't Gigi Donnarumma. You're correct on that one. I feel like I want it to be Zaire Emery. I feel like I'd love it to be Zaire Emery, in fact.
I'm sure that there will be PSG fans screaming at this, but I am going to put my hand down and say it's Vitinha. And from that, you can take us over the Alps and into Italy.
Okay, indeed. I've got AC Milan here. No idea how close that is to the Alps, but we'll...
Not miles away. Not miles Italy? Away. It's northern Italy. We're in the right kind of spot.
Fair enough. Well, we've got a lot of American listeners and they're going to enjoy this few minutes, Jack, because I think Christian Pulisic has actually become AC Milan's most important player.
Do you?
I do. Now, this is definitely up for debate.
Yeah.
I'm not going to claim that it's not. But I think Liao should be the most important player in this team.
I think he's definitely AC Milan's best player in terms of, you know, the levels of raw talent. But I don't think that he's harnessed that on a regular enough basis to actually be considered in this. He was not the player I was going to edge for.
Yeah, no, I can imagine you going for someone more obscure than this. But Liao is, yeah, clearly the star of the team and the probably most important star that they've got listed, but he's just inconsistent. And Pulisic absolutely is not inconsistent. Even tonight, I've watched their game against Bayer Leverkusen, and Milan didn't play well, and they've done this a few times this season. They're a very, very good team on their day, and then they're having these performances here and there that are just way too patchy and just not coherent. But Pulisic is having an unbelievable season. He's the best player in Serie A in terms of goal contributions since, I think, the beginning of last season. And you also get, though, a defensive effort out of Pulisic that is, in my eyes, like above and beyond what you get of most players of his type. And I think that that is hugely important. He's so determined. And I think when I say determined, it's also determined to make the most of this moment, because his status as a great player is probably a little fragile and has become fragile ever since he went to Chelsea, because that was probably the wrong choice for him. It just didn't turn out to be the move he should have made, but nobody was to know that at the time. And he's really having to work hard to prove just how good he is. Now, I'm sure all our US listeners are loyal Pulisic fans and will trust him and are putting everything on him to carry them to the quarterfinals or however far they can go at the next World Cup. But I actually think, even beyond just comparing him to Liao, there's an argument that Pulisic has been their best player this year based on the consistency of performances, because you don't get many consistent performances across an AC Milan team. And I think that his biggest test is going to be that he's going to be targeted and teams are just going to try and sniff him out, because it's starting to look like no Pulisic, no party, to be honest. Like, that's how important I think he's becoming to this team.
Yeah, I mean, I do take your point, but my problem with this as an argument is that if you take Christian Pulisic out of this team, Samu Chukwueze comes in, and I think Samu Chukwueze is brilliant. Now, is he going to be putting out the same levels of output as Christian Pulisic has started this season with, or actually, to be fair, as you say, over the last two seasons with? No, I don't think so. But I think that the drop-off is less extreme than it is with Mike Maignan, who, for my money, might be the best goalkeeper in the world, for what it's worth. But even though Milan have upgraded a little bit this summer in bringing in Marco Sportiello, you look at what's happened there, and Marco Sportiello hasn't really played a full season, you know, kind of regularly since he was on, you know, since he was at Frosinone on loan in 2018-19. And you actually look back at that and you think, okay, now he's at a point in his career at 32 where he can be a backup goalkeeper. That's absolutely fine. But, you know, Atalanta started loaning him out after that 2016-17 season, and off he went, right? He went over there, he went to Fiorentina for two seasons, he went to Frosinone on loan, he went back to Atalanta, he played a little bit, you know, as kind of a cover goalkeeper, but he then was released to go to Milan. And I think that the drop-off from, you know, for my money, the best goalkeeper in the world to a Marco Sportiello, who is a fine backup, but, you know, nothing special, is much more drastic than the drop-off from a Christian Pulisic to a Samu Chukwueze.
You can't give this to a goalkeeper. You can't say the most important. Do you know what? I think I've probably got in my mind that I criticised Maignan quite a lot in the Liverpool game. And I didn't think he covered himself in glory there. And maybe that's tainted my view on whether he'd be the most important. You're right in terms of that backup perception, which is what we've been talking about a lot in the show. So that's fair. I'll say the most important outfield player for AC Milan this season is Christian Pulisic.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, to be fair, if you're just making it as this season, I think there's a fair argument to suggest that the answer is Pulisic. In terms of general play at this point, I think it probably still is Maignan.
Yeah, well, Pulisic will be at like Real Madrid or Barcelona next season at this rate. So,
well, if he carries on like this, there's no reason that he won't be. Let's flip to the other side of Milan, the blue and black side, where things are a little bit more settled. And this was also hard, because you look at what Inter have going on, and they're kind of, again, another team that are really based around a system that everybody knows their roles. We talked about continuity when we were discussing the Serie A episode, and that was the thing we thought would lift them to the title this year. And therefore, it becomes difficult. Now, Everybody knows I'm a massive Barella fan, but actually I think that my two answers would probably be Hakan Çalhanoğlu, who was the self-proclaimed most creative six in the world last season, and Alessandro Bastoni, who is such a crucial part of this back line. Now, I'm sure there are lots of people going, what about Lautaro?
Lautaro.
Yeah, and I get it. And Lautaro is very, very, very important to this Inter side. He's the captain. He was the leading goal scorer. He was capocannoniere last year as they went to the title. He's an absolutely phenomenal player. And as I said before, I think he should be on the Ballon d'Or podium this season. But in terms of where Inter are, and having watched a little bit of what they did tonight, Mehdi Taremi played up front, played really, really well. Marcus Thuram has been the man who's actually taken on the goal-scoring load since Lautaro kind of had a little bit of a drop-off towards the end of last season. He's only scored a couple of goals since February for his club, at the very least. He obviously scored some very important ones for his country over the course of the summer and won the Golden Boot at the Copa America. But for his club, Marcus Thuram started to take the load off him, I think, in terms of goal-scoring responsibility towards the end of last season. Now, that's allowed Lautaro to do other things in terms of, you know, the way he helps build up play and all these things. But I do think in bringing Taremi in this summer, if Lautaro went out for 6 weeks or whatever, I think Inter would probably cope. Whereas I do wonder if they lost Çalhanoğlu, would they be able to maintain the same kind of system? Now, Christian Aslani is in there, who's a, you know, decent player. You can play Fratesi a little bit deeper as well. But I think that what Çalhanoğlu brings, and not just his dead ball ability, which will on show again on Tuesday night, scored an absolutely glorious free kick, but actually the way that Inter control games through their midfield is very, very, you know, locked in to the way that Çalhanoğlu dominates the ball in those areas. Now, it's really easy to pick a six all the time for this, because I think that in the way that modern football is, that player feels like the rock on which so many teams are based. But I think for Inter in particular, and the way that they switch play so often, actually it's Çalhanoğlu and Bastoni that are maybe the best players in that. And that takes me on to Bastoni, because whilst the rest of this back line does feel like there are times where you can kind of just flip players in and out, we obviously see Damian playing at right wing back sometimes. We see Damian playing at right centre back sometimes. We've seen lots of different ways that this side operates. But I do think that just in terms of what Bastoni brings to this back line, you know, it doesn't matter who he's next to. If he's next to Acerbi, if he's next to De Vrij, if he's next to Benjamin Pavard, it almost doesn't matter. His ability to switch play is so crucial, especially when Inter are playing Dumfries on that right-hand side, who sits, who basically, you know, again, is pretending as he's a striker for most of his career. It's really interesting to see how that switch ball opens teams up. It's been Inter's kind of calling card for so long. And I think that Çalhanoğlu and Bastoni are the absolute basis on which they're able to do that so much. Which other side gets their fullbacks or wingbacks as high as this, bar maybe Leverkusen? Almost nobody, right? So You're looking at this and thinking, well, how does the ball get out to those areas? Well, it's these two. And that's why I've gone for these two ahead of someone like Lautaro, who obviously is crucial, but I think that the drop-off to his replacements is probably slightly lower.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's the drop-off factor again that wins that one. I mean, the thing with Çalhanoğlu is, when you watch Inter, it becomes pretty clear that the tempo of the game tends to increase once he starts to dictate things, right? He will, I don't know if it's that he's just got better vision of what's about to open up than anybody else. I don't know if he can see things nobody else can. That's definitely plausible given that what we've seen in terms of his rise.
We see him a bit faster, I think. Maybe not that no one else can see it. He just spots it before anyone else.
And that's it.
It's all about thing, isn't it?
The speed of play of Çalhanoğlu in every sense is better than almost anyone else in football right now. And that probably does make him more important, because if you can see things, maybe not that no one else can, but quicker than anybody else can, then that is going to give you an edge. And maybe that is what has been giving Inter Milan an edge.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a fair shout. I mean, I think Bastoni's in this conversation. I think Lautaro's in this conversation, but
yeah, I mean,
for my money, it's Çalhanoğlu that is the
he's
one
good at
that
set pieces as well, I've heard.
Yeah, scores a few free kicks in that. So, you know, just an incredible player, and it's lovely to see him kind of step into that Brozovic role. Everyone was like, what are you doing? You're playing Çalhanoğlu deep, and he just transformed himself into
the
six. And it's been phenomenal to witness. So yeah, shouts out to Hakan Çalhanoğlu. I think probably Inter's most indispensable player right now.
Wow.
Let's go to our final Italian team, which is Juventus. And look, there was so much change over Juventus at the summer. It becomes very difficult to kind of pin this down. Off the top of your head, What's your immediate gut reaction?
There isn't one. It's my gut reaction. My gut reaction genuinely is that they don't have an MVP. I don't see it yet because I don't know what the team is. Like, if you had to tell me to pick one, the person in my head straight away is Vlahovic, but that's not the right answer. That, do you know what I mean? Like, that is who it should be by now. And that is who I want it to be, I think, because I absolutely love him. But it's not him.
No.
I don't even know which part of the team you go to. I assume it's in the midfield, to be honest, that you have to look towards.
So it's another one a little bit like Gravenberg here, and it's another Dutchman, actually, that I think by the end of this season, Theun Koopmeiners will be the answer to this question, right? I think that when Koopmeiners starts to become the guy for Juventus, he's going to really become the guy. He's going to be the man that links defense and attack. He's going to be the man that, you know, is looked to control the tempo of games, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think the Koopmeiners will become this by season end. But right now, I think the answer is Gleison Bremer.
Yeah.
I think that, one, he is one of the very few in this side who is there to kind of maintain the balance between the old era and the new. Secondly, I think he's probably one of the best centre-backs in the world right now. He very, very rarely ever makes a mistake. He is physically dominant. He's aerially dominant. He's excellent on the deck. There's almost nothing he can't do. And look, even when he was at Torino, he was up there with the best defenders in Serie A. So to go to Juventus, slot into a team that has such defensive pedigree and come out of it smelling of roses is pretty incredible, I think, from Bremer. So I think that's where, after a lot of soul searching, because I kind of want the answer to be Koopmeiners because I'm a big fan, right? And like you say, it should be Vlahovic by now. We haven't put really any strikers into this conversation yet. I think we will get to that point. But I do wonder, when you kind of look at this and you think, well, what's the kind of glue holding this back line together? The answer is Gleison Bremer. And the fact is that Juve haven't conceded a goal yet this season. So yeah. in Serie A. And so you look to that and you think, well, at the weekend, it was a different goalkeeper. Di Gregorio didn't play. It was a different left back. Ruhi played. Kalulu played centre back instead of right back. Danilo played at right back. There's been so many changes to this defensive line so much this season. And yet, Juve have gone defensively perfect in Serie A. They only conceded one goal this season, and that was obviously in the last minute to PSV, ended up not really mattering in terms of the general kind of sense of that game. So what do you look to? Well, Juve have an absolutely incredible back line. And what's the one player in there that is feels like kind of unchangeable, unshakable, what it's all built on? It's all built on Gleison Bremer. And so I'm going to go with Gleison Bremer.
And they had massive fear over losing him and managed to get him onto another new contract, right? Not too long ago, in fact, it was in the back end of the summer. And so that shows you how important he was to the continuity. And when he signed that contract, you know, Juve released the statement talking about how delighted they were and that he was extending his contract again and would be there until 2029. And everybody was very happy with it. And then within their statement, Juve kind of talked about the impact that Bremer had actually had on the club. And it said that over the last two seasons, he had made 83 appearances, all of which had been as a starter. In that time, no Juve player had made more appearances. That's how important he had become. And obviously that was not like a great period for Juventus. It was not a time when fans are going to want to look back on with fondness. But those were times when it was a lot of the time literally like almost backs to the wall stuff, like scrapping for your lives, nil-nils, and trying to hold out a lot of the time. So now when you go into a time which is a bit more hopeful, you've still got to sustain what got you through the tough times. And maybe you're right. Maybe Bremer is an important, force that just keeps this team together and also symbolizes where they've come from and what they're actually about. And that's like being defensively resolute, making ball recoveries, winning his challenges, winning his headers, weighing in with a few goals here and there as well. I think that's a good call actually, mate.
Okay. All right. Well, we will leave part two there after the break. We're going to be making our way back through France. It's not going to be the last time we go through France, but it is the last time we're going to talk about French teams because we're going into Spain and then we'll return to Germany to round things off. Stick with us. Welcome back to part three of Ranks FC. We are going to España, Dean, and I'm going to start us off, I think, in Barcelona. It is further north than Madrid, so we'll start there and then go over to the city rivals in the capital afterwards. I was thinking about this, and I texted the rank god, Sam Tai.
Did you text the rank god?
Because I thought about it, and I texted him, I said, is it mad to suggest that Lamine Yamal is Barcelona's most important player at 17 years old? And if so, because we're kind of saying if he is, then he was already Barcelona's most important player at 16 years old. And that's kind of wild. But equally, I think that this one is slightly different to a lot of the others in that actually a lot of this is based on kind of being able to hang your hat on someone. Barcelona fans, since Lionel Messi left the club, have basically gone through a variety of different players. Ansu Fati was the next big thing, given the 10 shirt. Everyone was very excited and then spent last season on the bench at Brighton. He's now on the bench back at Barcelona, but still not really having any impact in games. Lamine Yamal came into this team at 16 years old, fearless, and immediately Barcelona fans went, we've got a new guy. We've got a guy who we can believe in. And everything we've seen from him so far, for both club and then for country on the Euro stage this summer, has been pretty much nothing short of sublime. Now, Lamine Yamal has a lot hanging on him already, so I don't want to put any more pressure on his head because it's kind of wild how much everyone is depending on Lamine Yamal to fulfill his potential. But it feels almost disingenuous to give this to anyone else when every time Lamine Yamal is out, it doesn't matter who else, whoever the 10 players are that play with Lamine Yamal, if Lamine Yamal is in the lineup, Barcelona fans are like, probably all right. Now, I don't know if you can get any more invaluable than that. And obviously, this isn't just about fan bases, but I think it really matters in terms of these feelings. And with that, I found it very difficult to look elsewhere. Now, I think you can make a case for Pedri, because I think that with Pedri on the pitch, Barcelona feel like they move the ball better. They're able to actually get their most important players into the game more regularly. The ball, you know, Lamine Yamal has more space to operate in because Pedri understands how football works better than almost anybody his age. But I can't shake the feeling that if you had Barcelona's 10 best players minus Yamal on the pitch and he wasn't there, there would still be more worry than if you played 10 kids from La Masia and Lamine Yamal. And that is about as comprehensive an argument as I could possibly make.
Yeah, I mean, we knew he was going to have a good season and we all were looking at it and we were like, will he be backed up this season, basically? If Barcelona are going to make a proper run at the title, then he needs some backup here. And to be fair, he has had it. I mean, Rafinha has suddenly found the type of form that we never thought we were going to see again at Barcelona.
And the captain's armband.
I mean, it's crazy. I saw Fabrizio Romano tweet today that Rafinha is literally flying. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, he's got another string to his bow there that I really didn't know.
Fair play to him.
So he's got another string to his bow now. We definitely won't expect.
That's remarkable.
But look, Robert Lewandowski, he's top scorer in La Liga, mate. He's turning up this season. We knew that this would be necessary if Barca were going to make an impact and actually challenge with Real Madrid this season. And to be fair to him, he's getting the numbers. I'm not saying like it's like Lewandowski of old, but in terms of importance, that might be hard to match.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting with Lewandowski this season is that he seems to be just in the right place at the right time again. And that was one of the hallmarks, right, of his incredible time at Bayern, that you just seem to find Lewandowski in the right spot over and over and over and over again. Hmm. And that is pretty crucial, right, to the way that all of these things operate. So there is definitely an argument to be had there. I just wonder if Lewandowski goes missing, that, you know, Pau Victor obviously had a great preseason. He scored his first goal. Yes, it was a mistake by the keeper at the weekend. He played a little bit off the left rather than actually in his preferred position. But I think that you probably play Ferran through the middle. You change the system, obviously, a little bit if Lewandowski goes missing. I just worry with Lamine Yamal that if he was to get injured, you know, and let's absolutely pray, everyone I think involved, I'm sure that Real Madrid fans are laughing at me right now, but just in terms of his career and his progression, his potential, like Lamine Yamal getting a serious injury at this point would be about the worst thing that could possibly happen to football, I think. So you're kind of looking at this and thinking, if that happened, I think that Barcelona's entire season would probably go down the pan.
Yeah.
Whereas I wonder if Lewandowski got injured for a bit, if Barcelona would find a way to play without him, and the emotional stress of that wouldn't quite take it out of everyone else in the same way that it would if it was Lamine. So I think it is Yamal at this point. And that sounds so ridiculous. I appreciate it, but equally, I can't look past him.
I think it's right, mate. I mean, this is like saying a young Messi, when he was coming through, was the most important for Barcelona. And of course, it turned out to be true because...
It did turn out to be true, but it probably wasn't at the time.
I mean, at that time, obviously, the team was a bit different than the makeup. But in terms of like, Messi could have had this same effect, obviously, on a team that wasn't already great. And that's what you have to consider here too, in terms of an importance factor. It's like, he is the future of this club. Like, he is going to be a genuine superstar whose face is on billboards and all the rest of it. Like, there's no way that that's not going to happen to this lad. And that makes him the most important player in the team because they're going to build a future around him.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, do you want to flip the Clásico?
Yeah, so it's Real Madrid and it's Jude Bellingham and you can just talk about everything. No, I'm joking and joking. It's not Jude Bellingham. I tell you what, I'm not even going to talk about Jude Bellingham here, to be fair. Valverde has become the most important player in many ways because of his emergence and his style of play and the role that he's had to fill. And in many, many ways, I think that he is right now the most important player in this team. But let's come back to him in a second because there are two other players, or three other players that I have to really address. None of them are Jude Bellingham. I'm going to leave him parked for today. But Luka Modric just played 86 minutes in the Madrid derby at the weekend. And that shows his continued importance to this team. People spoke in the early weeks of this season about how much they're missing Toni Kroos. The players spoke about it. The media spoke about it. Fans noticed it. And he's irreplaceable. And obviously they've had other injury problems too. And the fact that Luka Modric has had to play 86 minutes of one of the biggest games of the season shows you that like he's going to continue to be one of the most important players in that team.
Without Toni Kroos in the side, Luka Modric's importance is re-upped. Like last year, Luka Modric was definitely not the most important player in the Real Madrid team.
Yeah, this was supposed to be
a
chill year. I thought it was like seeing things out. Turns out that can't happen because they need him all the time.
His importance has gone right back up through the roof.
Yeah. But then that has a different type of importance to their two forward players in Mbappe and Vinny. Now, Mbappe's going to be the main man at Real Madrid. And I've said before that he's going to be the superstar and Vinny's going to become his sidekick. But I think the most important player to Real Madrid continues to be Vinicius Junior. The track record of important goals, the ability to stand up and be counted when it matters. And I'll tell you what, I mean that as a person as well as a footballer, actually, because
absolutely
what he signifies now is like above and beyond the game. And I think that that leaves him actually above everybody else. Like, you could throw Bellingham into the conversation, but even Bellingham knows he's not right now. You see the video the other day, Bellingham's introduced onto stage as Madrid's main man, Jude Bellingham, and he literally eye rolls and like hates it because he's like, that's not it. That's not it. I'm just a footballer at Real Madrid. Like, don't need to hype it up to be anything more than it is. And I liked that moment for him, to be honest, because I was like, that just shows that he knows where he's at. But for Vinny, I think, this season, 10 goal contributions in 10 games, 3 goals, 7 assists. But it's not about this. It's about when March, April, May rolls around. That's when Vinny matters. And the guy will deliver. We know that. He's done it constantly in the Champions League and in La Liga. Last season, whether it was Leipzig, Man City, Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund, none of them can handle him. And that continues back through the years where he's playing Chelsea or Liverpool, whoever he comes up against. This guy knows how to make game-defining moments and decisions matter, and that's what makes him so, so important. So in these early stages, yes, Valverde is absolutely important to giving them that platform, but it's so that Vinny can go and finish things off at the back end of the season when you actually claim your glory. So what is more important there? Is it the guy that's helping you have those foundations, or is it the superstar that finishes things off? It's difficult to finalize a decision on it, but it's probably Vinny, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, I would probably say Valverde, but I absolutely appreciate that.
It's two different roles. That's the thing with
it. It's the Rodri and Haaland debate all over again, right? Like, we're having the same conversation. I would just add that I think that maybe Antonio Rudiger should be in this conversation.
Yeah, I mean,
because I think that Real Madrid are incredibly light at centre back. I've been saying it all season. I thought that a big injury there and they look really in trouble. But also you kind of come to that and you think, well, actually, what does Rudiger do? He marshals this defense as well as everything else. He is the man who pulls it all together. There's loads to kind of think about with that. But I think you're right. It's probably a two-way battle. My hand would come in for Valverde, but I will absolutely accept Vinicius Junior as an answer on this one as well. Let's go to Atleti quickly, because I think it's two veterans and I'm not sure which it is. Now, this week we saw Antoine Griezmann retire from France duty. I think, and I said this on SiriusXM on the radio earlier this week, I think that that is an absolute hammer blow for France, because Griezmann is one of the most unselfish, incredible footballers I think that we've ever seen. I don't know if we've ever seen as talented a footballer as Griezmann with such an incredible work rate. Like, someone who is able to produce moments of magic that almost nobody else could produce, but also is willing to kind of sacrifice all that so he can go charging around the pitch and do everything for his team. He is the epitome of Simeone's Atleti. And he has just been so good for so long. When Griezmann plays well, Atleti play well. And that's like the basic ultimate end of this, right? He is the man to which they turn in a moment of crisis. And for that reason, I find it difficult to look past him. But I would probably suggest that Jan Oblak has a shout here as well, because he's been so important to this team for so long. He's one of the captains of this group. Obviously, him and Koke share kind of captaincy duties most of the time these days. He has got a say still in kind of making them the wall that they can be. And yes, they've tried to change things around a little bit this summer. Yes, it's all a little bit different. But I think the answer to this question for Atleti is still very much Griezmann or Oblak.
Yeah. Wow. Goalkeeper's getting so much love today. Yeah. I mean, with Atleti, it runs a bit deeper because of the way the team runs. It's difficult to know what the most important factor is, because for Simeone, it's obviously that grounding in, like, being determined, never giving up. And there are some figures within that Atleti team that epitomize exactly what he wants in that type of player. And Angel Correa, for example, like, is absolutely epitomizes like an importance to a manager and a team. Like, he's right there because he's never giving up, and he will come up with defining moments, saving moments, and will continue to do that whenever you need him. But if you're gonna drop the overall picture, then it's difficult to make an argument it's not Griezmann.
Yeah, I think that's right. Right, we've got one team left to cover. We're going to go back up to Germany. Should we take a quick look at Bayern Munich? Because this one's tricky in so many ways. I mean, there is obviously an argument that it's Harry Kane, given his goal contributions. But I do actually wonder if the answer is not Kane, but maybe Musiala. And I wonder that if it's not Musiala, actually it's the revived, absolutely crucial Joshua Kimmich, who is back in central midfield. They tried to move him out of center midfield last year. Thomas Tuchel said he couldn't play six. He wasn't able to do it. They brought in Joao Palhinha, can't get off the bench. Cannot get off the bench because Joshua Kimmich is the exact six that Vincent Kompany is absolutely looking for, because he creates, he controls, he destroys. And actually he hasn't missed a minute of any Bayern game so far this season. Now, I'm absolutely willing to sit here and listen to an argument for Harry Kane at this point, considering how important he's been. But I do wonder if just Kimmich's resurgence and revitalization in centre midfield has been a crucial part of why Bayern have started this season so, so, so well.
Yeah, probably is. But I think if you were to say which of those three players are you willing to go without, I think it would be Kimmich. I think that that's the player that you feel that you could go without out of those three. I think in Harry Kane, he's top for goals, he's top for assists. Who knows how many he ends up with on both fronts across this season. And goals win titles, right? So like you're gonna pick Harry Kane. But then Musiala is one of the most wanted men in European football. Every top Champions League club would want to sign him right now. He's 21 years old. He's not nearly reached what he's going to become capable of. And we'll find out how important he is to them in terms of what Bayern Munich are actually going to offer him on a new contract to make sure that he stays with them. That's what's going to really tell us how important he is, because Man City will bite their arm off. If he becomes available, if they get a sniff that they could get Musiala, Pep and all his mates will be there saying, come here, come to City, we'll take you. But Bayern, I don't think, can let that happen. I don't think they will let that happen. Does that mean he's the most important player in the team? I don't know. But he's going to be the most important player for the future. And that's where you kind of have that fine line there with Bayern.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to find out about Harry Kane by the looks of it, because he's touch and go to play in the Champions League tomorrow. Matthias Tell obviously has an incredible goal scoring record, still very, very young, seen as one of the top prospects. But, you know, if he gets a couple of games here and he starts to put that pressure on, well, what does that look like? Can you drop him if he, you know, if he comes in and scores, you know, a couple of goals in each of the games that he gets an opportunity in? He scores pretty much every time he's on the pitch. So it is interesting to see what will happen if Tell comes in for a couple of games and does well. Michael Olise has obviously been absolutely brilliant, but I wonder what would happen if Musiala actually was absent. Would they play Thomas Müller there, or would they move Olise inside and push one of Sané or Coman or the rest of the incredible attacking core that they have to actually come into that side? It's really interesting kind of seeing it turn out and how it kind of shakes. But I think this one feels like personal preference. It's another one where Bayern feel incredibly strong this season. It feels like the unit is so well put together. Yes, Harry Kane is on the sharp end of this. I do think my hand might go in for Joshua Kimmich, just in terms of leadership as well as anything else. But you could probably make that argument for Kane at the same time, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to go with Kane for now. I'm going to say that's why they bought him, to be their most important player.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. And they spent a lot of money on bringing Harry Kane to the club. So
the reason you spend that much money is to be the most important guy in the dressing room.
Yeah, perhaps. And look, his relationship with not only company, but the rest of this Bayern team seems to be such a wonderful thing as well. He's slotted in there so seamlessly that's a fair argument as well. And with that, DJ, we have completed our little tour.
Brilliant.
A lot of fun there. Some building blocks to discuss.
My brain's a bit scrambled, but it was a lot of fun. And I bet people have been shouting at their phones or radios or whatever they've been listening to us on going through that episode. But I think that was the great thing about it. It's about opinion, that one. And as I say, most of mine will probably prove to be right, but everyone's entitled to their own.
Usual confidence from the
guru. You've got to have confidence or you've got nothing.
Yeah, 100%. Right. So we're going to call this episode here, but we are going to be back tomorrow with a Champions League takeaway that'll be available shortly after that round of games on Wednesday has finished. But for now, all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. Thank you all so much for listening. This has been Ranks FC, the world's best transatlantic football podcast. And we'll see you very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.